Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Just 50 years ago, more or less to the month, was published in Britain a book by a then scarcely known Austrian philosopher, Karl Popper, entitled The Open Society and Its Enemies. There were three. The initial print run was 300 copies, and the publication had come as the culmination of an amazing saga involving 95 letters, no less, going from New Zealand to Britain in war-torn communication, with Ernst Gombrich acting as Karl Popper's man of affairs in London. And it was actually Ernst Gombrich who saw the text through the publication stages of the book. Simultaneously, of course, others were reacting to that experience of war and totalitarianism in other ways. Jean Monnet wasn't in the book writing business, he was in the institution creating business. And I think it's very appropriate that we unite those two very different kinds of response that we saw in Western society 50 years ago to the challenge of totalitarianism. The Open Society and Its Enemies, of course, was a passionate attack on the philosophical tradition, as Karl Popper saw it, which gave rise to Nazi and communism, totalitarian regimes. Jean Monnet was not about attacking something, he was about trying to create a quite different environment. He was a builder. And one of the very exciting, I think, responses in the West to the events of 1989 has been a sudden realization that the attractions of open societies are all very well, but they're rather unspecific. There are many kinds of open societies, and a lot of the debate about what kind of society we would like to build, now that in the eyes of many we are free to begin to do so, have hinged around the debate of a civic or a civil society as one version of an open society. There are, of course, subtle distinctions between civil and civic societies, and indeed distinctions between that and communitarianism, which it's somewhat related. No one, I think, is better fitted to sketch out what we now mean by the civil society and to identify for us some of its enemies than Professor Ernest Gellner, who knows the LSE far better than I ever will. He's been here, man and boy, I'm tempted to say, for longer than one can decently say, and been a professor in at least three of its departments. So, without more ado, it would be an impertinence of me to introduce him here. Without more ado, can I invite him to give his lecture on civil society and its enemies, Ernest Gellner.
Thank you, Director, for this great honor of having asked me to give this lecture. I'm very grateful, of course, particularly because it's in this institution, which, as you say, I had a long and important connection with. I'm deeply grateful to it for various reasons. You found it indecent to specify the year. I didn't quite see what's indecent about saying it was, in fact, 35 years of service. And I'm proud of it and grateful for it, and it makes this a very moving occasion for me. As you also say, the title of my lecture is a clear allusion to the book which appeared 50 years ago, Karl Popper's Open Society and Its Enemies, which perhaps I ought to begin by saying is the book which influenced me more perhaps than any other single theoretical book. It had made an enormous impact. It's remained with me ever since, and it is the basis of much of my thought, for what it's worth. I stress this because I have to. One of the things I have to begin with is making some criticisms of it, which explain why some work needs to be done. The Karl Popper's Open Society is, of course, the, at least in my view, the most important formulation of the case for liberty in this century. It's a poem. It's a kind of philosophical poem. It's exciting. It has some defects, which are important. It either one of Karl Popper's lifelong characteristics has been a certain contempt for sociology, so that the book either lacks a sociology or hints a mistaken one. This seems to be an important weakness, because we do need to know the preconditions and the general social conditions of what it is we value and what it is he argued for so powerfully. The theories which are hinted at are not really terribly satisfactory. They're the kind of, first of all, they're the conflict within the book. The strength of the book is that it very persuasively links two great miracles: the possibility of sustained and cumulative growth of knowledge, in other words, science, and the miracle of a free society. But having linked them, he then torn in his theory of both of them between a continuity theory, it's always with us, in which case it's very difficult to understand what the problem was, and a theory of kind of miraculous liberation virtually by personal virtue. Neither of these I find very satisfactory. If it's our birthright, if it's a part of an ongoing process of trial and error stretching from the A. Moeber to Einstein, well, it's very difficult to see why there was the problem. But if, on the other hand, it's the achievement of individual virtue, it seems to me to place too great a burden on virtue. And on both counts, I prefer to investigate something which he didn't do very much, namely examine the social conditions of the kind of society we value. And what I'm going to talk about is basically that. I apologize, Director, that what I'm going to say might be both stale and incoherent. The staleness comes from the fact that I've thought about it a long time, and I'm given to publishing, and it's been said before. And the incoherence springs from the desire to say something new without having fully worked it out. But there it is. I'm presenting you with work in progress. Well, the shift from the notion of or term open society to the term civil society is, of course, connected with the fact that civil society has emerged as the key slogan of liberalization during the couple of decades or so which preceded the collapse of Bolshevik totalitarianism. Not only has it emerged as the main slogan, I think it is a good slogan. It is very superior in various ways to the term democracy, which also serves the same purpose. And I perhaps begin by why I think civil society is a valuable term. It unquestionably has emerged as a political slogan during this period. A quarter of a century ago, if someone spoke about civil society, he was probably a historian of ideas, and is probably a tiny bit dull. I mean, it's obviously the term has a history in Locke, and above all, it has a history in the Hegelian discussions, which is very, very difficult to make sense of. And suddenly it has shifted from the dusty pages of history of ideas to actually vibrant and moving political life. Why so? Well, it's fairly obvious. The term contained in a in brief form, a summary of what it is that East Europeans were missing. In one way, it, of course, a central aspect of Marxism, that it claimed that civil society was a fraud, and both the relationship between civil society and the state was fraud. Civil society was not fair and balanced as it claimed to be, nor was the state a fair arbitrator protecting and mediating the conflicting interests within it. Civil society was unfair internally, and the state was a servant of unfair interests. And once this kind of inequity engendered both within civil society in its narrower sense and in the wider partnership between it and the state were abolished, there would be no further need for it. The fraudulence of civil society was one of the central tenets of Marxism. Well, the success of Marxism persuaded those who lived under it eventually that this is precisely what they wanted. And I think it's a good summary. It's better. It's a better term than democracy for the following reason. The appeal of the term democracy is that it contains within itself a theory of its own legitimacy. Democracy belongs to a whole class of what might be called naturalistic or this-worldly theories of validity, which answer the question of why the norms in some sphere of activity were to be justified by appealing to this-worldly considerations. Empiricism in knowledge, utilitarianism in ethics, similar theories in aesthetics, the appeal to experience, sentiment, interest, consent, namely human characteristics or human decisions rather than some transcendent authority. And the notion of democracy has the same merit. It contains the self-evident theory of legitimacy by saying, well, authority, obedience, institution of coercive agencies within society is justified by the consent of the governed. What else? Either because the governed no longer accept some transcendent authority or because they have rival views of it, and instead of quarreling about their rival views of the transcendent, they agree to run their social order on a human and humane and mundane basis. This is the theory contained in the word of democracy. It's very unsatisfactory because in practice, democrats, and I have to say, of course, unfortunately, democracy only works under certain conditions, and these conditions seem to embrace a large number of historical periods and social types. And there's something very odd about a theory of legitimacy which is unlimited and unconditional and is meant to apply universally, which then, for some bizarre reason, can only be implemented under various conditions. It's very funny. What happens to those parts of the world where those conditions are not satisfied? Well, the notion of civil society has the advantage that it promises less and delivers more. It doesn't claim some kind of universal validity. It's not like government by consent or by agreement, a kind of dreadfully simple and universally applicable notion. It's meant to be specifically and concrete, and the conditions, instead of being arbitrarily attached ex post to the normative theory, are actually built into it. And that, I think, seems to me an important advantage. It gives us a more realistic approach to our political valuations than perhaps the notion of either democracy or open society. Well, what is it? When the expression acquired its political potency in Eastern Europe, if one asked people what was contained in it, I think the answer would have been very simple, and as far as it goes, perfectly adequate. They would say what they have in mind is a pluralist society without monopoly of power, without a single center of authority, without a monopoly of truth either, a society in which the state was strong enough to ensure the maintenance of order and the maintenance of the shared social infrastructure, which are the two main tasks of a modern state, but not strong enough to monopolize the social world, where there were rival institutions and associations strong enough to check it, control it, in some measure, criticize it, and prevent it from being the unchecked and unique center of power and source of truth. Now, this definition is perfectly adequate as far as it goes in the context of the East European situation as it was during the run-up to the collapse of Bolshevism. From the viewpoint of theoretical analysis of the term, understanding what is really involved, it is inadequate. And in order to see its inadequacy, I think one has to go back to a debate which took place mainly in early 19th century France, which is part of the ancestor of modern social science, namely the critique by men such as Benjamin Constant and later, more profoundly and more thoroughly, by Fustel de Coulanges, of the French revolutionary rhetoric which equated modern liberalism with ancient liberalism. Now, the argument against that equation is, of course, was very eloquently, above all, formulated by Fustel de Coulanges, and it runs roughly as follows. The ancients meant by liberty absence of a tyrant or absence of foreign domination, but they did not mean individual liberty, and the ancient city in its free condition functioned by the use of social, heavily ritualized and very demanding social subunits, which for the modern taste would be intolerably stifling. Fustel de Coulanges was in fact telling his competitors, you wouldn't put up with those conditions. The ritual and other demands of the subunits whose membership or the precondition of the membership of the city would be intolerable for you. It's an important point. It wasn't merely absent from the rhetoric of the French Revolution when it invoked the ancients as a kind of example and political model. It's a point which escaped somebody as intelligent as David Hume. In his very important reflections on the connections between religion and liberty, he conflates the liberty of the ancients and of the moderns, and then gets suddenly terribly puzzled because the answer comes out wrong. In the context of the ancient world, priests were the friends of liberty and enthusiasts were its enemies. Priests and enthusiasts are code words for pluralistic, traditional, ritualistic religion and enthusiasm for doctrinal, consequently heresy-hunting religion. In the ancient world, the shift meant a loss of liberty, and then suddenly he's puzzled by the fact that the scripturalist Puritan Unitarians in the modern world, in Holland and England, helped liberty along. So he gets very puzzled and tries to wriggle out of it, but he failed to see that the answer was not that in one condition the same factors favor liberty and in another they do not. The answer is that it is a very different kind of liberty. And in order to make this distinction, absent, as I say, in Hume, absent, I think, in the Augustans, and only emerging in the 19th century, I will attempt a schematization of human society, which will also enable us to see what civil society, as we now conceive it, what it amounts to. And I'll use a blackboard. for the purpose of a simple diagram. Now, it seems to me that two basic distinctions are important for an illuminating typology of human societies, and they are independent of each other, engendering a reasonably neat and simple two by two diagram. There are societies in which social considerations of the maintenance of order and stability, internal order and defense to the outside, trump economic considerations, where the notion of augmenting production is unrealistic or totally absent. Incidentally, I would say this is the normal human condition, that the kind of society in which we live, in which augmentation of a total production is crucial for political legitimacy, is extremely exceptional. It was absent most of the time, and I suspect, though I don't wish to dogmatize about the future, will disappear again. Then there are societies in which economic growth or augmentation of the total wealth is not necessarily dominant, but relatively high, or at least usurps some of the importance of the order-maintaining or coercive features of social organization. That is distinction one. Other distinction, uncentralized and centralized. Power may be concentrated in society in a single center, or sometime in a single stratum, or it may be widely diffused. Now, the classical city, which Hume and the rhetoric of the French Revolution conflated with modern liberty, clearly is somewhere here. And of course, the descendants of Fustel de Coulanges, who really established the distinction, are contemporary social anthropologists, and they generally use the term segmentary for that kind of order. A segment of society is one which internally maintains order by division and subdivision, where groups check each other and police their own members in fear of attracting retaliation from rival groups, where internal discipline in the groups is maintained by heavy ritualization and a sustained kind of social obligation, but where power is diffused, usually very widely diffused, sometimes seldom is extended, of course, to women, but sometimes extended as far as the entire male adult population, or at least heads of household. A society in which decentralization is maintained, but the economy becomes rather more important, they call this the ancient city-state. This one is the commercial city-state. Some segments of societies organize themselves in a manner such that trade or even production become relatively more important and an access to power. Type two. Perhaps one should say these, well, I'll come back to that. Third type, centralization and a low place for the economy, the traditional authoritarian state. Civil society, and of course, this is the point of my diagram, is the one which combines centralized maintenance of order. It has an effective state, but of course modern civil society places very high value on production, and of course production is, the division of labor is pushed further than in most other societies, at least by certain criteria, by some other criteria, there's greater homogenization. But this division of labor have as its precondition that the producers do not need to waste their time, energy, and training on martial skills and maintenance of internal cohesion. The modern office worker cannot be expected to shoot his way from his home to his office and computer. Society simply wouldn't work that way. There's one exceptional society which for a time appeared to work that way, and that was Lebanon, but that was very exceptional indeed. Some agrarian societies can work in this way, as when tribesmen dig trenches between their houses and their fields, because on their way to work they have to escape the shots of their rival. But this is feasible in some agrarian societies. It's not feasible in this one. So we've got this fourfold typology. Now, I will enrich my typology of human societies by one further variable. I already have the relative place of the economy and the degree of centralization. My third variable, the board is unfortunately two-dimensional, there's some difficulty in putting it on, but my third dimension is ideological zeal. It just so happens that man is an ideological animal. We do possess language and the capacity to theorize, and we sometimes take our own theories very seriously indeed, sometimes not. And whether or not we do so does constitute a further element in engendering the typology, which I like to think helps us to understand both what civil society is, what its mechanics are, and perhaps why we value it. Now, corresponding to each of my existing four types, there is kind of ideologically overheated variant. Let's go through the block. An ideologically overzealous, fanatical variant of segmentary, ritualized, undoctrinal society is a very rare phenomenon, though it did preoccupy one of the earliest, and still I think one of the best and most illuminating theoreticians of civil society, namely Adam Ferguson. Adam Ferguson was very preoccupied with Sparta. Sparta is a society which continues to organize itself in a kind of segmentary, ritualistic, localized manner, but pushes the virtues normally associated with that kind of society, namely martial skill, courage, cunning, and cohesion, to a kind of fanatical degree. It's a rare phenomenon. It's interesting for the typology. It's not a very important practical option. Commercial city-states did, of course, develop their ideological variants. Calvin's Geneva, John Knox's Scotland, call it the Calvin-Knox alternative. The traditional authoritarian state probably has a number of ideologically passionate variants, but the one which perhaps is most interesting for various reasons is Islam. The ideological variant of a modern type, politically centralized, production-oriented society is, of course, Marxism. The thesis that Marxism leads to totalitarianism has, of course, been stated many times. Hayek, Popper, and others. There's nothing very interesting about it. I would like to put forward the kind of converse of it, which is less obvious and may seem more contentious, namely that under modern conditions, any totalitarian society must be Marxist. If it fails to be so, it will be incompletely totalitarian. Now, the argument is the following. I don't, of course, mean by Marxism the rich and varied cocktail assembled by the two founding, founding fathers of Marxism in the half century between the 1840s and the 1890s. They read a lot, they read everything that was going, and they kind of assembled a cocktail, as it were, from Hegel to Morgan. And that is an accidental concoction, and the suggestion that any totalitarian state must embrace that particular concoction would, of course, be absurd. What I am saying is that the central moral intuition of Marxism is inescapable for modern totalitarianism. The idea that partial or sectional control of the productive machinery is inherently pathological, that in order to establish the rule of righteousness on earth, the productive process must be brought under, in effect, central or, quote, social control, that is a cogent argument, because, of course, a modern economy is so powerful that Lenin's dilemma, who does whom, does apply. Either you control it, or eventually, either it will control you or attenuate, it will acquire a very significant independence. If, and Adam Ferguson, quoting Xenophon, makes a definition of totalitarianism, if you like, the overheating of the ideological element, precisely this requirement that virtue should be the business of the state. If you make virtue and salvation the business of the state, under modern conditions, you have to control the economy. Otherwise, there will be an important and very powerful zone outside your control, a kind of rival center of power, influence, which will prevent you from being fully totalitarian. I think this argument is valid, so that Marxism, in that sense, in that restrained sense, is the inevitable corollary of a genuine totalitarianism. Well, if you accept my typology, we can then look at something which doesn't follow from the typology itself, namely the characteristics of each of the types. Sparta we need not bother about, it's rare. The segmentary state is highly stable, or it may be the illusion of the stability, the kind of illusion, in as far as segmentary societies reorganize themselves on the same principles when they undergo some turbulence. But they are found all over the place in history, and they are, of course, found all over the place in ethnography, and survive well into modern conditions. This is highly unstable, and so is its ideological variant. The interesting thing about commercial city-states is that they don't last very long. Italy is the only place which had them twice, both in classical antiquity and in the Renaissance. They emerge, but they do not emerge. They do not last very long. The most famous statement in Marxism, namely that history, the history of class struggle, is probably largely inspired by these societies and by the fact that their intellectual brilliance has given them a quite disproportionate place in the European consciousness. The European vision of society and history gives greater place to Periclean Athens or Renaissance Florence, then it gives to other societies. If you look at human societies at large, the thesis about the ubiquity of class struggle is kind of somewhat metaphysical. It's only true in some kind of latent sense. Classes are there In some potential way they may be in conflict, but in very frequently they're not in conflict. But the generalization about conflict of values and conflict of groups, something on which Plato and Marx agreed, is very conspicuously true about this kind of society. Sorry, a bigger one. Traditional authoritarian state, again, a hardy and pervasive plant, which seems to correspond to one, certainly one possibility of organizing human society. Like Islam, an interesting phenomenon, because it's not only this ideologically very serious variant of the traditional authoritarian state is not only stable, but actually appears to be stabilized and strengthened by modern conditions. The really striking thing about Islam is, unlike all the other world religions, it is secularization resistant. That on current form, that would seem to be a very stable social form. Civil society, question mark. In the sense in which I'm discussing it, it has only happened once, although, of course, then on an enormous scale, appears to be conquering the world, though again, that is the question mark, and in the two great confrontations of our century, in the Second World War and in the Cold War, it came out victorious, though I don't think this should legitimately inspire excessive complacency. Marxism, highly unstable. There's seldom been social science could seldom boast of an experiment of carried out with quite such thoroughness. On my count, and it depends on how you count, there are 29 sovereign states, so even sovereignty is questionable now, 29 sovereign states between West Germany and China. They covered the available variables with almost unbelievable thoroughness. They include Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, Shiite, Sunnite, Buddhist, and shamanistic societies. They include societies, many societies without previous democratic traditions, and some which had them. They include industrial and non-industrial ones. They include pastoral ones. They include forager ones. They include societies where Marxism was established by an internal development and others where it was established by external conquest. That virtually every variable is covered, and the end result was astonishingly unanimous. It's a curious fact, one very, very seldom gets in generalization about human societies any demonstration of quite such conclusiveness of the unviability of a social order, both in the internal experience, notwithstanding the diversity of baselines, and notwithstanding their political independence of each other, the end result was astonishingly identical. Well, I'm offering you a definition of civil society in the context of a typology, i.e. a society which is politically centralized, which order maintenance is not the business of individuals. None of us are expected to engage in feuds or dueling. We are expected to ring the police. The curiously ethnocentric definition of the state of Max Weber's as the possessor of a monopoly of legitimate violence, which doesn't apply to states in general, does apply to the modern state. Private vengeance and private rectification of wrong is excluded. It's a politically centralized society. It's a society which places augmentation of wealth and economic growth at the very center of life. In fact, it's one of the two main principles of legitimacy, together with the satisfaction of nationalist criteria. And it's a society without ideological zeal. Perhaps one of its most important features is the emphatic privatization of virtue and salvation. Society, the social centralized institutions have the job, of course, maintaining order and maintaining an absolutely enormous infrastructure, a feature sometimes forgotten, but it is not their business to either identify or enforce virtue and righteousness. This is the definition. Question now arises, or a number of many questions could arise, about its roots, preconditions, and future. I think there are three main, and I'm sorry if I'm obvious, there are three main preconditions of this kind of social order. One of them, of course, is economic growth. This, this is a society in which the Platonic problem of how you keep order without being devoured by those who keep order, how do you restrain the sheepdogs from behaving like wolves, is solved by the fact that it's in there they are better off if they do not devour the sheep. And of course, the reason why it is better for them is that everyone is better off in an economically growing society. To return to Adam Ferguson, because Adam Ferguson watched the emergence of a civil society, the society in which the citizens no longer looked after their own safety and were arms carrying, an awareness which was accentuated by the relative disarming of Scotland, notwithstanding the French danger, because of the unwillingness of the authorities to put arms into the hands of potential Jacobites. This worried him, and of course what worried him, and his preoccupation with the classical world fed this, of course we are better off, but if we delegate defense and maintenance of order to specialists, will we not sooner or later fall into the hands of a Praetorian dictatorship? That is a sort of central problem which bothered Ferguson. How is it that we, who are no longer like Spartans, will nevertheless maintain our liberties and our affluence? And he worried a great deal about it. Well, of course, the answer was that, contrary to the pessimism of the early commentators of the transition, who thought that originally thought the Industrial Revolution was merely engendering one of those temporary shifts away from martial values to productive values, which will reach a ceiling, there will be a kind of point of diminishing return after which our liberties will be in peril again. What they did not realize that eventually the transition, which in these cases was always temporary, fragile, haunted by conflict, and in the end collapsed, as, of course, Plato maintained it must, that on one occasion it was bailed out by sustained economic growth based on a technology, in turn based on it, for the first time in history, on a genuinely and continuously cumulative science. One condition, growth. Second condition, intimately connected with that, is the multi-state system. Now, this is terribly important. I said the civil society, in the sense, a growth an affluent and growth-based liberal society is based in a way on bribing the wolves. Now, that's not quite a sufficient explanation, because the wolves, they're quite liable, like everybody else, to be fools. It might not necessarily be their interest to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, but they will do it nevertheless. They will reestablish a different kind of social order because, well, they're just stupid. It's just a fact. Now, and of course this happened twice in European history. There are two occasions of the reversal of the move towards civil society by the reestablishment of some mixture of this maybe sustained, anyway, of the other type. One of these efforts is known as the Counter-Reformation, and the other one is known as communism. In both cases, the attempt was thwarted. The golden egg-laying goose, or the societies rather, which killed the goose in question, then lagged behind economically, that either they were defeated in war, that astonishingly, in the 18th century, the nations of shopkeepers repeatedly, on 18th and earlier, in the Dutch wars against the Iberian monarchy, and the English wars against the French, the shopkeepers defeated the military aristocrats, even though the latter were more numerous, which is one of the, of course, facts which really inspired the liberal politics of the Enlightenment. Either the goose-killing societies were destroyed in war, or in our century, in a Cold War, in an economic competition. Now, in other words, the victory of a liberal, growth-oriented society was conditional on a multi-state system, so that the goose killing did not take place throughout the whole of Europe or the whole of the world at the same time. So the second precondition, growth, a multi-state system. The third condition, which I won't spend a great deal of time on, is of course the main theme in sociological theories concerning the emergence of modern society, namely the emergence of self-policing, probably under the impact of Protestant individualism. Now, the point about these three preconditions is that none of them can be expected to last. The point about a multi-state system probably cannot survive a condition of very powerful technology. The ecological and terrorist consequences of modern technology are such that the imposition of some kind of international order are a precondition of survival. That doesn't mean, of course, that it will necessarily happen. Needs do not engender their own satisfactions, but it makes it reasonably likely that the kind of pluralism which provided the insurance based on the distribution of political eggs in a variety of baskets, that kind of insurance will gradually cease. The self-policing element, again, has been thrown in doubt. The core theories about the disappearance of individualism a generation or so ago, associated with names like Riesman or W.H. White, are always with us. Whether it's well substantiated or not, is an open question, but at least it's reasonably possible It's certainly the ideological bases which originally engendered it are no longer operative. And as for growth, strange though it may seem, in a world which continues to be growth hungry, partly because a great deal of genuine poverty is still about, or the values are still based on its recollection, nevertheless, government by generalized bribery cannot go on indefinitely. That seems to me a logical truth, better formulated perhaps by the late Fred Hirsch than by anyone else. The argument is not so much that there's necessarily a ceiling on growth in a physical sense, which may or may not be the case, as that there must come a point where additional increments in material goods no longer make any genuine impact on the human condition. We are in any case in well-developed societies, in advanced societies, we are in any case in a kind of condition where additional material wealth really has, as Hirsch of course pointed out, significance only as a means to status rather than inherently. So it's a sobering thought to reflect that the three permanent aids of the emergence of liberal society cannot be relied upon to remain with us. Well, there are other sobering thoughts, but I think I will come to those sobering thoughts in the discussion. I see that I've overstepped the 45 minutes which the director has given me, and I shall end at that point and switch to what I prefer anyway, discussion. Thank you, Chair.
Well, we have a quarter of an hour or so for questions, and I now invite contributions from either the well-lit first floor or the ill-lit circle. I think I can just about see you all up there. And it's perhaps while everybody thinks, can I ask you just to pursue that last thought a little bit further? You said that there were three preconditions for a civil society emerging, but that doesn't necessarily follow that once emerged, it requires those three to continue. I mean, the conditions for emergence are not necessarily the same as the conditions for sustaining existence.
No, but I mean, the obvious danger, if the multi-state system disappears, and I think it should, because of the ecological and terrorist consequences of the kind of international free-for-all, if it disappears, it means that if there's one authority, one mistake will do us in. We won't have this, that's one. Secondly, once people are no longer bribed by the anticipation of the further wealth, because they've reached a saturation point, what I consider the normal human condition, i.e. order trumps growth, will again reappear. I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. You can say that the draconic disciplinary systems of agrarian societies were just an expression of barbarism, savagery, cruelty, sadism, or you can say that human beings cannot be governed without those things. The only reason why this kind of society has become relatively liberal and tempered in its system of suppression is because people are bribed by the constant anticipation and reality of growth. Once that ceases, we may well have to revert to some kind of authoritarian imposed order. It's a logical possibility. Likewise, the multi-state system disappears, bribery ceases to operate. And, of course, the theories that self-policing is diminishing are very widespread. I don't know whether that's true.
Well, it might be, but, I mean, I wouldn't have thought it necessarily has to be. After all, One only has to look at the salaries paid to directors of utility companies in the UK to realize that there is no limit to people's cupidity. I mean, there seems to be no reason why one should want £5 million a year rather than £4 million a year. But people undoubtedly do and work very hard to achieve it.
People do, yes. But I mean, it seems to me unlikely, though it seems at the moment, to rely on permanent government by social control by generalized bribery. I think it would be risky to rely upon it. I've got another thought on that, but I won't.
Right. In case. Well, now, Magnet.
No. The ecological thing, ecological and terrorist considerations will impose a centralized authority, I think. That's a separate argument. Capitalism, government by bribery, people will, I do think, will reach a ceiling. Yes. And you will not be indefinitely able to govern people by anticipation of growth. I mean, the example of refusal to be governed by it, of course, is the counterculture. A counterculture which, now this might grow. And of course, one of the significances of the collapse of communism is that as long as it looked as if the world was going to be polarized between capitalism and socialism, the counterculture, even if it didn't refuse in the end to idealize the communist world, nevertheless thought there is an alternative, and so on. Now that the alternative has been removed, the counterculture may become more powerful. Let me give you, I'm impressed by the following historical parallel, by kind of inverse Leninist argument. Lenin thought in order to get somewhere, you had a disciplined party. On the contrary, the disciplined party was a kind of septic tank in which radicalism was neutralized, made harmless. And long as the very able and dynamic leftists were in the Communist Party, they were totally harmless. It was Khrushchev's speech and the liberalization of the left which made them really dangerous, made them for a time take over the Labour Party and so on. Now, the same seems to me could happen to the counterculture. The counterculture no longer tied to a non-functioning rival ideal based in Eastern Europe, but kind of liberated in its fantasy, might become really very powerful. And I mean, I want to argue from the particular case of the social sciences to the world at large, but in the social sciences, the kind of mood of anything goes antinomianism is very widespread. Now, this could seep over into the rest of society. I'm not saying it will, but it's a possibility. I didn't say it's economic determinism, but go on.
A strong, functioning economic society. Surely that's the antithesis to a civil society. That in a strong, centralized state, where the key is on developing the economy, you're not necessarily taking into account the liberal and pluralistic needs of the populace.
No. Point about civil society is a strong centralized state which monopolizes the maintenance of order. None of us came to this meeting armed in order to shoot our way home again. So we know that on the whole, order is maintained. There are, of course, the decline of central cities and so on. But order is maintained, but astonishingly, unlike most other social types, those who concentrate the order-maintaining power in their hands don't use it to fleece the rest. The salaries of high military officers are rather small compared with the managers of big companies and so on. There's no military caste. People go into the military profession and out of it like any other profession. They don't get specially high rewards. How is this possible? Well, the answer is partly they know ration. Since the nations of shopkeepers started beating the nations of military aristocrats, they realize that wealth is not to be found in coercion. This lesson was really learned finally and definitively in the aftermath of 1945. And this wouldn't stop foolish officers nevertheless taking over, but they can't do it thanks to the multi-state system. So that the strong, effective state is not an authoritarian state, it's an astonishing state which is strong enough to maintain order, but is nevertheless bound by law and does not interfere, does not throttle the economic process. No. In fact, I've never been so travestied as I have now, Edward. No, because I state the problem, it doesn't mean to say that I embrace the most foolish immediate consequence. I'm in favor of establishment of effective international authority which will suppress arms trade, drug trade, terrorism, and ecological folly. I'm in favor, eventually, when genuine poverty has been eliminated, of rethinking the concept of wealth in such a way that people get their status not by wasting resources on bigger cars, but directly. I'm in favor both of ecological termination of growth, central government, and I'm hostile to the sustaining of social order through false doctrine. If I'd come to the bit where I think how we can legitimate our commitment to civil society, I would have said all that. What you've taken is the problems which I've highlighted, that the factors which helped us in the past will no longer help us, and we must therefore look for other aids. And I'm not in no way in support of the things which you said.
Yes.
Well, come on, let's hear what you're saying.
Bit of a tall order. Well, I've hinted some of them. There has to be a rethinking of the notion of wealth and status. I don't quite know how you do this, but such that people do not, beyond a certain point, do not seek extra wealth. There has to be a devising of an international pluralism such that the plurality of culture centers, I'm in favor of some kind of federal, multicultural, international order where a central authority is strong enough to prevent nuclear proliferation, use of chemical, bacteriological weapons but at the same time not strong enough to suppress the diversity. It is feasible. After all, civil society has achieved it in the past, and it has to be achieved internationally. This is the kind of direction which we need to be thinking moving. The point about this is to highlight the problems so the solution can be found. There's a very deep contradiction between the liberal requirement of freedom of movement And the fact that as long as you get different economic levels, which you'll get for a long time, freedom of movement engenders massive labor migrations, which then are in conflict with the cultural homogeneity, which is also one of the conditions of effective functioning of society. So that liberty of movement and avoidance of an ethnic division of labor, inequality of cultural groups, consequently criminalization of the unprivileged ones because they're not full moral, I'm trying to highlight the problems. I don't pretend to have the full answer, but I certainly don't have the answers you credited me with.
Just time for two more, yes?
I'm curious as to the basis on which you categorize the Islamic society as a variant of the traditional authoritarian
society. A variant of?
Of the traditional authoritarian society. And if it is highly stable, is it because it is authoritarian, or is it because of its virtue and righteousness inclinations? And what basis are you judging it to be a variant of
Well, in fact, the characteristic, this is a big subject, but as you've raised it, the characteristic form of Islamic society has been a centralized authority coexisting with, of that kind, coexisting with segmentary units in the countryside in a kind of unstable balance. Point one, the reason why it has been very successful, the complicated matter, but I can try and give you the indication of why I think it is. The factors which have led to nationalism in Europe, namely the move from stable, hierarchical, well-organized little units where people find their identity in their place in the social order, to mobile, anonymous, but culturally homogeneous societies, that shift, which expresses itself in nationalism in Europe, has expressed itself in fundamentalism in Islam, and has actually strengthened Islam, or rather has strengthened the high version, the scripturalist, unitarian, doctrinal form of Islam, which, moreover, has affinity with modern conditions, in precisely because it's unitarian, scripturalist, Puritan, individualist, anti-mediationist. Modern society does not seem to really allow for sacramental priests. A society which makes believers symmetrically equal to each other and symmetrical in the relation to deity seems to correspond to modern requirements. All these reasons I would offer as the only explanation of the striking fact that Islam is the one religion which is not secularizing. That's the best I can do. Oh, put it another way, although, in fact, Islam has the great merit of providing a handrail in life, it regulates, it's a combination of a legal and a religious system, nevertheless, it doesn't secularize the economy. It leaves a profane area of social life. The reason why Marxism, in my view, collapsed so dismally is precisely because it rather pantheistic. It secularized the whole of life, including the economy, and when the economy became visibly squalid, faith disappeared. There was no profane bolt hole for the lukewarm believer to escape into until the next moment of zeal. Islam allows this bolt hole. Economic life is not secularized. Marxism, curious enough, secularized economic life too much. It's pantheism. It's strange enough that Spinozan heritage, which undid Marxism, was Islam had a great advantage there. That's roughly the direction in which I seek the answer to your question.
Final question, yes.
Unless we're bribed. Brief answer to your question is yes.
Well,
not all of us. There's some. I mean, if I face one of the problems which I didn't get around to is the feeble ideological underwriting of free society. Truth, i.e. any non-free society, is based on falsehood, but so who cares? And growth so far, but in the later stages of industrial development, it's no longer self-evident that individual liberty is a precondition of economic efficiency. The latest and most successful industrializers have often been authoritarian and resembled those stifling kin units in their organization rather than, you know, I mean, it's Confucianism seems to be a better business school than Calvinism at the end of the day. It's a strange fact, but it's a fact. There are some of us have an interest in liberty. We intellectuals, we would be stifled if we had to go back to a pre-Enlightenment world, and we do very nicely, some of us anyway, in a free society. So it's got my, but that's nothing very edifying about this. My self-interest is tied to it. Why should I generalize this? Other people may prefer to be in a world of Platonic illusion, where the social order and the natural orders reinforce each other, and where everybody has his place. I think one of the weaknesses of Popper's open society is that the vindication of the open society was a little bit sort of speech day-ish. It wasn't, I think one has to be really philosophically worried about its vindication rather than simply make rousing speeches on its behalf. Yes?
I thought for one amazing moment we were going to end on an affirmative and positive note. But Ernst, I do think we first must thank you for a fascinating, provocative and provoking lecture, which has done at least two things besides send us all away thoughtful. It's launched the Jean Monnet lecture series in the LSE under the auspices of the European Institute, and I hope Jean Monnet would have been pleased at the provocative things that you said about his project, or I'm sure what he would regard, partly at least, as his project. And secondly, of course, it's celebrated in the way I think that Sir Karl Popper would have most liked, the 50th anniversary of the publication of his book. Just before I invite you to join us all for a reception in the senior common room, can I just reveal that, at least according to Who's Who, 50 years ago, you were a private in the Czech Armored Brigade, and since you put that in your Who's Who, at least that's a touching tribute, I think, in a book which otherwise is full of field marshals and generals. Thank you very much.
Thank you.